All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Red Shirts and Runabouts. This is episode 5. I am Derek, one of your 3 weekly hosts. I've got my other 2 hosts with me as well. Jeremy, say hi.
Hello, hello.
And, of course, Greg.
How's it going, everybody?
Good to be back. This week, we are going to be talking about 2 different topics. First, our kind of big episodes that are family episodes of Star Trek, where the non-core crew members were involved. People's spouses, maybe children, parents, loved ones, etc. And then, of course, we'll be taking a deep, spoiler-filled dive into Star Trek Discovery Episode 6, Lathe or Leth or whatever. They didn't actually say the name of this one, so, you know, I don't know how to pronounce it. So, yeah, let's start things off. This topic idea for family episode was actually Jeremy. So, Jeremy, why don't you tell us a bit about your episode?
Sure. And, of course, this ties into the episode that we watched, Leth or whatever it is, because that does focus heavily on the connection between Michael and Ambassador Sarek. So I suggested we do something where it's, you know, it's kind of a pretty common trope in all of the Star Treks where they'll happen upon the family member of one of the core cast. The one that I picked was Inheritance, Season 7, Episode 10 of Next Generation, where they run into Dr. Tainer, who turns out to be Data's mom. So that is... The wife of Noonien Sung, the creator of Data and Lore and B4, though I don't think anybody talks about B4 anymore.
I don't know. It was never clear to me that B4 was actually a Soong creation and not just a ripoff.
You don't think so? I thought he was one of the Soong, like, class androids. I thought they were all made by him.
I don't know, because he's only in Star Trek Discovery as far as canon is concerned. So I'm not really sure if he's really a Soong creation or not, because they never really talk about, like, where he came from.
I mean, he looks like Data, who looks like Soong, so I assume he was just, like, the prototype for Lore and Data. I mean, that's why he's called B4.
Yeah, I mean, he very well may have been, and in the Beta canon stuff, he ends up becoming Data after Nemesis, since, you know, Data dies.
Uploads.
Yeah. But, anyway. Sorry, continue, tangent.
It's a real strong emotional connection episode for one of my favorite Star Trek characters, Data. And, you know, emotional connection for a character that lacks emotion, is always a fun sci-fi twist. So she kind of unveils a big part of Data's backstory, and it's fairly late in the game for Next Gen to be learning this big piece about Data, that not only does he have a mother, but his mother was who designed him and who is actually the reason he was left behind on Omicron Theta after the crystalline entity attacked, which is like a big core piece. So they meet her, and she kind of hangs out with Data and kind of wants to get to know him. But then after they go back down to the planet and there's, you know, an explosion or whatever, away mission thing happens, she gets knocked out, and it turns out she herself is an android and is the third Soong android creation that we meet, not counting Lol, or what is Data's daughter's name?
I think it's Lol?
Lol, yeah.
Lol?
Yeah. LOL. but then we get that he pulls the data chip out, and there's the holographic discussion, which is very much like Superman seeing the crystal and the where he talks to his father for the first time, but it's holographic and all that. A little bit of a parallel there, but yeah. Just a very familial, strong family episode that I liked. Kind of reminded me of this episode, and that it's kind of a weird moral choice, and also a big piece of backstory where we learn kind of why Data was left behind, which is another thing. Michael was kind of left behind in a certain way, as we'll talk about later in this episode.
Yeah, that's a really interesting episode. Part of me thinks some of it is some of its like emotional power was taken away when you find out that she's an android. But then at the same time, of course, we care about Data as much as we do, and he's an android, so that seems hypocritical. but that's a good episode.
I don't know. I think because, yes, she gave him the memories of the colonists so that she could make him more human, and then it was in Data's hands to make her more human by not telling her she was an android. So even though they're both, you know, androids, I think there's still a lot of emotional impact on that one.
Yes, that choice by Data I thought was a really strong character growth moment for him because yeah. You know, he still doesn't have the emotion chip yet at this point. So this is a real logical and thought out decision, but at the same time shows that even without the emotion chip, he still feels things very similar to what we would think the emotion is. And so what's the difference, right?
Well, and with the ability of what Lore had emotion-wise, it just reconfirms the Data that there is hope. That Data's not incapable of it. It was just the way he was designed right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. Nature mm-hmm. over nurture.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
How about you guys? Greg, do you want to do yours?
Yeah. Mine is actually a Season 4 Next Generation episode called Reunion. And it's the episode where Worf is reunited with Kalar and meets Alexander, his son.
Alexander.
And that's right, little Alexander. Who and Worf is just, you know, 5 minutes into the episode, Worf's immediately teaching him how to use a batleth. So I always kind of like that dynamic. But the thing I enjoyed most about it was, you know, Kalar was the actress, I'm trying to think of her last name here, Susie Plankson, was, mm-hmm. she's been in Star Trek, she's been in like, what, she's in Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Enterprise. She's a recurring actress on the show. But she's like a half-human, half-Klingon hybrid. They've already introduced her in the past. But she's involved with the, you know, the succession of Kim Peck, the Klingon Emperor, who is pulling in Picard to be the arbiter of succession. So you have that whole storyline. And at the same time, they drop in, oh, by the way, Worf, you have a son. And
yeah.
Twist. Worf, yeah, and Worf kind of realizes that Alexander doesn't know much about Klingons. He's a Klingon, but he doesn't know a lot about the history, about the what makes them who they are. And then it just, the show just doesn't hold back and immediately jumps into Duras versus Gowron and the Duras family trying to take away Worf and his family's honor. And, you know, the bombing and the assassination and all this stuff going on. And Kalar's, just like any Klingon female, just one-to-one equal with everybody around her, challenging them, finding evidence of what Duras is doing. And, you know, Duras kills her. And, you know, on live TV, they kill Worf's, you know, mate. And Worf takes off his badge. He takes off his armored sash. He grabs his batleth, leaves Alexander in the room, and goes over to the Klingon ship. And he slaughters Duras. And they're all challenged. The Klingons are all initially making fun of him, insulting him. You have no honor. But then the other Klingons realize, like, oh, you know, well, Kalar was my mate. And it's that whole dynamic where it just repeats that even though her and Worf never finished a Klingon mating ritual, aside from having, you know, a son, but the marriage part of the ritual, let me put it that way. They didn't, just details. They didn't finish the marriage part of the ritual. He had always considered her his mate, and he had always considered him her mate. And the Klingons acknowledged it, and, you know, Duras is whispering into his face when they're fighting. He's like, you know, if you kill me, you'll never be able to prove your honor. And Worf is essentially like, I don't care. This is my vengeance. You killed the woman I loved. You've left my son without a mother. And the Klingons are all like, they're like, for lack of a better term, they're cheering him. They're all supporting him as he does this. And he kills Duras, essentially, in the long run, making Gowron emperor. You know, I mean, we got a few more episodes to go before the Civil War happens and all that. But
right.
Then he goes back and Picard's furious with him. And it's the Klingon part of, I mean, obviously he is Klingon, but he's relying on his Klingon heritage. And he's saying, look, according to Klingon law, I did nothing wrong. And it's a reminder. And the other reason I love it is at this point, Worf is essentially part of Picard's family on the Enterprise. Picard doesn't have, you know, a wife or children, but he's got his crew and his people he's mentoring and training and leading. And, you know, it's like I'm trying to think of the exact terminology, but Picard's like asking him if he wants to resign, and Picard was disappointed in him. And that hurt Worf. And it's just, you know, Worf lost his mate. He lost Kalar. Now he's got a son and he's disappointed his captain. But technically he did nothing wrong, the Klingon law. So it's a pretty depressing, you know, family episode. But Worf's, yeah. Data is one of Jeremy's favorite characters and Worf is absolutely my favorite. So.
Yeah, it shows that dynamic of, you know, the Klingon Empire versus the Federation, right? And that, yeah, we're allies, but the cultures are still incredibly different. The laws are still incredibly different. And at the end of the day, Worf is still a Starfleet officer and needs to follow the rules of Starfleet. And that's where that really comes into play. And the fact that Picard has helped Worf multiple times, you know, with clearing his house name and things like that, that his opinion of Worf is very important. So,
no, it's a good point. So, Derek, how about to you?
So, as luck would have it, I also picked a Worf-centric episode from TNG, so we can kind of see where our wheelhouses are. I picked the Season 5, Episode 16, Ethics, which I also actually wrote about in the ATB publishing book that we gave away on our contest last week. So if you want to check that out, atbpublishing.com/TNG, and I wrote about ethics. And this episode is really intense. Worf gets injured. He breaks his back. He's supposed to never be able to walk again. And at the same time, he has his son there. You know, Alex is there. And he's already lost his mother. Worf is his only real family other than, of course, Worf's human parents who barely know Alex. And Worf is basically choosing to die. He is choosing what he believes to be the honorable death of a Klingon, the Hegbot, I think is what it was called, which is basically assisted suicide. It's ritual suicide by Klingons. And it has to do with when they can no longer be useful to society. Of course, what we as humans deem useful and what Klingons do varies. And in this case, Worf is basically saying, if I can't be chief of security and fight in battles and, you know, get my honor that way, I'm nothing but a burden to everybody, so I should just die. And he tries to get Riker to help him with this because he needs assistance, and Riker refuses to help, and everyone's trying to push him to work and things like that. So it's this real dichotomy again of what does it mean to be Klingon, and he has to decide between these old, maybe rigid rules if you read them too literally versus the spirit of the rules. And of course we know he heals and gets to be blown over the bridge multiple times in the future, being in more Star Trek than any other single character. So yeah, ethics.
That's a good one, because I remember the two doctors, Crusher and I can't think of the other doctor. They were arguing about whether or not to do the spinal surgery and the spine recreation.
Yeah, Dr. Russell.
That's it.
Yeah.
And there was the whole...
Everybody's favorite Starfleet doctor, Dr. Russell.
Yep. But yeah, I remember she's no Pulaski, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, this is pretty politically relevant at the time, too, because I think this was when Kevorkian was a big thing in the news, so like assisted suicide was kind of a hot button issue, and for them to tackle it with Worf was pretty politically charged at that time.
Well, and something else about the ethics did, which we're definitely going to talk about the more Discovery it goes on, because it ties directly into one of the big theories on Discovery of that we were kind of making fun of a couple weeks ago about how, you know, There's a hidden Klingon on board the Discovery and blah, blah, blah. But I remember Ethics did that whole spiel about how Klingon anatomy was different and like vastly different.
Right. Yeah. And they've mentioned it multiple times, you know, later about how they have redundant organs and all this other crazy stuff. And, you know, even in the original series in the Undiscovered Country, it was a problem because Bones didn't know Klingon anatomy.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right, well, that, I guess, is that. Let's move on to Star Trek Discovery Episode 6, Sixth Lathe. Before we dive into spoilers, just overall your spoiler-free thoughts What did you guys think of the episode?
I liked it. It seemed it was a good, you know, kind of contained story. And, you know, anytime we don't go too far into Klingon territory, I'm happy so far with Discovery. So this is a good one. I always like when we get a lot of Tilly, Michael hangout time so we can kind of develop those relationships. I was a little disappointed that we're halfway, I mean, not quite halfway through the season, but almost halfway through the season, and we've really not met any other characters. We've now had more, like, emotional character development from, what's her name, Caldwell? Admiral Cornwall. Cornwell, something.
Oh, the Admiral?
Yeah. So I'm big whenever we see those Michael Tilly interactions. I was a little disappointed in this episode that we didn't see anything else from the other characters. I just feel like we keep getting deeper and deeper into Discovery without developing the cast and crew. And, like, we've seen so much of Admiral Cornwell, and we've seen her and Tilly and Saru and, you know, Lorca, but we just haven't seen anybody else, and we keep getting these moments where, you know, it cuts to them, they're reacting to things, they're obviously part of the crew and, you know, have interesting things to offer as characters, but we just don't know them yet, which is a little bit frustrating. I wish they would, you know, spread the love a little bit more. It's just kind of the Lorca and Michael show so far.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, of course, the original series had the big three, but the other shows all were very ensemble heavy, and this show is definitely not doing that to any of that same level.
Yeah.
Greg, how about you? What about your spoiler-free thoughts?
spoiler-free thoughts. This is my least favorite of all the Discovery episodes so far. And the main reason for that is not almost individual character actions that we'll get about when we get to the spoiler section. To me, the storyline and the things that happened all felt telegraphed. Like, this had to happen for this just so we could do this. And that's just what I didn't like that. You know, the interaction with the people was okay. I do absolutely agree with Jeremy. It's might as well just be called Star Trek, you know, Burnham and Lorca. Which, you know, and maybe it's because they didn't know they were going to get a second season, so they only focused on a few characters. Maybe there will be more. But that's...
Oh, yeah, we should take a moment to talk about that hot Discovery news that they just announced season two.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's happening. Maybe not till 2019, but it's happening.
Well,
they did officially announce that we're getting a second season of Discovery. No real details as far as, like, episode count or production timeline, but the estimates are sometime in 2019.
Well, it's good to see that Discovery's doing well enough that they're making enough money that they want to continue with, you know, the Excelsior of 2017, the great experiment, is Star Trek Discovery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I genuinely didn't have faith that they were going to hit the whatever numbers they needed for that, because I know a lot of people have been so turned off by the paywall, but I guess the numbers are good.
Well, I mean, we have to remember, of course, that in most of the world it's on Netflix,
right?
Which most of the world has. And so I think it's been seeing, you know, I think I saw some number like 12.4 million viewers.
Oh,
which,
that's great.
I mean, you know, that's a pretty major primetime show. Most shows don't get numbers like that. We're talking like Stranger Things numbers.
Yeah. And if it has a year to live between season one and season two where it can live on Netflix and not just CBS All Access, I think it'll pick up even more. I mean, just in the American audience.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I will say that, you know, the American audience is not used to being patient. I know, like, in the UK, it's very common for a show like Sherlock, for example, or Luther, to go a couple of years without a season. Yeah. And Game of Thrones is doing that for the first time here, and people are not super thrilled about it, but they didn't do it until seasons, you know, 7 and 8, versus this is season 1, and now you're going to have a year and a half gap between the end of season 1 and the beginning of season 2. A lot of people are, you know, might kind of forget about it, lose the hype. So I'll be curious to see how they ramp the show up for season 2.
Yep.
Me too. Hopefully, maybe they'll go back to the old school where they actually do 24 episodes. Just like, I doubt it.
That would be expensive.
Because most shows don't do it, yeah. But it'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, 15 is more than most. I mean, the Netflix shows are usually between 8 and 13.
Yeah.
And we got 15 after the expansion from 13. So I would imagine season 2 will be 15. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. They do have the sets built for Discovery. Of course, we don't know how the season ends. So we'll have to kind of wait and see what happens.
The thing I do enjoy about the show so far, as much as I didn't like this episode, is there's not a lot of wasted time in these episodes. Like, that's been one of the big complaints about Game of Thrones since, like, season 5. Is there will just be 5 or 10 minutes where these two characters are doing something that has no relevance to the rest of the plot. It's just there as filler. And Discovery's not really doing it. There's filler, but it's filler that somehow is involved in what at least the characters are doing with the overall storyline. And so I want to stop myself before I start getting into spoilers. So
yeah. So yeah. Well, let's just go into the spoilers. The only thing I'm going to say before we do that is that I ran into my first technical issues watching the show. I could not watch it Sunday night.
You and a lot of other people.
Yeah, it was weird. It was like it would get pixelated and jump ahead an undetermined amount of time. And you know, I tried everything. I tried rebooting the app and rebooting the device, my internet, the whole nine. And then, of course, the next day it comes out that lots of people had that problem. So keep in mind that this does not affect most of the world. But you know, for a show, a modern show in the social media era, I had to then be careful because I'm a huge Trekkie. I'm in so many Star Trek groups and I follow so many Star Trek fans and people that I had to be really careful not to get any spoilers for the episode. Not that like a ton happened, that would have been spoiled, but
yeah.
Either way, so that happened, but I got to watch it last night. So, okay, let's dive into spoilers. So if you haven't watched it yet, give us a pause, go watch episode 6 and come on back. Okay, so if you are still with us, so Greg, let's start with you, because I know this. You said this was your least favorite episode of the show so far. Why don't you tell us a bit about why?
Well, you know, the opening stuff wasn't the problem. The whole, the Sarek, he's doing ambassadorial stuff. He's going on a Vulcan ship to do negotiations, and there's the Vulcan, for lack of, I don't know what to call him, so I'm just going to say what it is. He's the Vulcan terrorist that blows up the shuttle. Strand Sarek, he's got the mind meld, the long distance intergalactic mind meld, which we can laugh at, but it's whatever. The intergalactic mind meld with Burnham kind of snaps her up. Everybody realizes, oh, wait a second, Sarek is hurt, and he's stranded. I'm like, that's cool. I like that, because that's tension. That impacts a character for Burnham. You get the whole Burnham storyline, which I'm going to let the two of you guys talk about how, you know, with the mind meld and all the stuff going on with her and her past. I'm like, that was cool. The choices that Sarek had to make with the Science Academy, the expedition team, about Spock versus Burnham. And by the way, both your children are, one's human and one's part human. That's unusual, Spock. That's cool. I like that. What started to lose it for me was when Cornwell and Lorca were on the ship. And I don't mind the love subplot, the romance subplot. I get that. They're two adults in wartime. They're facing death every day. I don't mind that. That makes perfect sense. What did it for me was the moment she's talking about disciplining Lorca and all this stuff. And then as she's leaving his ship, she's like, oh, and by the way, you know, I'm going to discipline you when I get back, because I'm going to go fill in Sarek's position to negotiate with the Klingons. The moment they said that, I was like, well, they just threatened to take away his ship, and now she's going to get kidnapped by the Klingons, and that storyline's not going to be relevant anymore. And
so it's interesting you thought that, because I actually thought that Lorca had sabotaged the shuttle.
Ah.
Well, yeah, that's kind of what I felt like they were hinting at, was that she's put in this situation where it would be in Lorca's benefit for her to get in trouble, and he's like, well, we'll have to send her away. But it's kind of vague as to whether or not that was his intent. Like, he wanted this situation to happen.
Oh, I think he definitely did. I mean, the fact that Saru's response to what Lorca says, you know, no, we're not going to go after her. Let's see what Command wants us to do. Let's get our authorization. Because Lorca never gets authorization for anything.
He never does that. And
the littlest thing.
And that brings up the point of, is it possible that did he warn the Klingons that they were sending an admiral instead of Sarek? Because they all knew Sarek wasn't going. So
no, I don't think he did that. Because I don't know how he would.
Ash could have.
Well, and that,
I mean, maybe Ash, Ash secret Klingon might have had a connection there somehow.
So in which case, her just arriving just happened to be perfect for the Klingons, and that's when I was like, okay, unless there's some sort of subterfuge going on, she's going to land and the Klingons are going to take her out somehow. And I just, I thought it was, that was just, that's just me. I thought it was weak.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that coming, definitely.
Like, it would have been cooler to me if what they would have done is had the Klingons immediately announced, we do have her, and Lorca be Lorca. Like you guys said, this is unusual for him to be all carefree and whatever, we're going to wait for orders, as if he just would have immediately gone insane and said, you know what, we're going after her.
Yeah, I was thinking about it a little bit as I was watching, and I think there also might be the layer that maybe Lorca feels more comfortable being carefree because he has Admiral Cornwell on his side, so he can like always get away with not following orders because she will always back him up when it comes time to, you know, be held accountable. So now that she's not in the mix and he has to deal with all these people that aren't as willing to put up with his bullshit.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And we don't have Kirk around yet to show if you constantly disobey orders, you'll just get a promotion or a new ship.
Right.
I mean, it's an interesting point. I think for me, it almost would have made more sense for him to go after her because then she's in his debt again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but on the same side, though, you can tell he really, I think she might have been the last person that he truly trusted. You know, he's put a lot of trust in Burnham. He's now putting trust in Tyler. But I think she was the last person that he connected with on any real human, non-military level. And when she threatened to take his ship away, not even threatened, when she told him straight up, you're going to lose your ship, at least for a while. Once that was clear to him, he lost that only connection to humanity that he had left. But I do think he sent her to get trapped or maybe even killed. I think he realized it was a trap. I think he realized that this was not going to go well, and wanted to get her out of the way.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a big piece of it.
So is it possible Lorca is not just playing in shades of gray, that he's truly a legitimately evil captain?
He's not evil. He has...
I mean, he still wants to serve the Federation.
Right. It's that thing where he has a goal, and he is not going to let anybody get in his way of that goal. Right? So his goal is for the Federation to defeat the Klingons, and for him to keep his ship, because that's the most important thing to him. And he will do whatever it takes to get those things accomplished. He is not moral. He is not ethical. I'm not sure I would call him evil, per se.
So if this was Dungeons & Dragons, he'd be more like chaotic neutral.
Right, exactly.
Or true neutral, I think. Yeah.
Or true neutral.
I mean,
I've been
watching Enterprise, and it reminds me a lot of Archer stealing the warp coils in the Delphic Expanse, where it's just like he's straight up resorted to piracy because he has this goal and it's wartime and he has to save like humanity as a whole. It's like, it's not necessarily an evil move, but it's definitely Machiavellian.
I see. But, okay. I really liked that plot thread in Enterprise. And for me though, I felt like it was the hardest decision he ever had to make.
Oh yeah.
That definitely. He had the weight of all of humanity on his shoulders. Literally. If the Enterprise can't make the Zindi back off on their own, the only Warp 5 ship, then we might all be killed. He really thought that was true, and he hated what he had to do, but he felt he had to do it. I don't think he ever really forgave himself or was comfortable with that decision. Versus with Lorca, where I feel like he just, if you're in his way, he will deal with you.
Yeah. And that's another theme, I think, of this episode that we see the parallels. We see characters kind of becoming their true selves. So we see Michael finally at the end of this episode kind of breaking that Vulcan facade of emotionlessness and getting a big smile on her face and saying, hi, let's meet for the first time. I'm Michael Burnham. I'm a human. At the same point, we also see Lorca saying like, please don't take this away from me. This is all I've got. Like, I think mm-hmm. that's the true Lorca that he puts the wall around, is the scared guy who has seen some dark stuff and kind of feels backed into the corner, and that his only weapon against every, you know, the world that is conspiring against him is the Discovery.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a good point. We see a lot more of who these people are, and that goes for Tilly, especially because you learn, you know, where she begins the episode and ends the episode. She has found a path for herself, and she's a very confident person. You know, she may be a little socially awkward at times, but we all can be. And she is very confident in who she is and what her abilities are. And she continues to really be a fun character that I'm really into. I really like seeing her on screen.
Yeah, I was desperately saving up dilithium in Star Trek Timelines on iOS so that I could try and get her as a character from this event that they're doing. And I just keep getting Tyler covers. I've got three Tylers now, but no Tillys. It's really disheartening.
She's still the character I can relate to the most. Just because she is awkward, but she's happy. She's confident, but she's weak at some points. I'm like, that's it. She's not every character has to always be stoic and perfect. I mean, I get Burnham, because she was raised with Vulcans for, what, 18 years at least? So I get that. I get her stoicism. But I kind of like seeing these character flaws in Lorca and Tilly. Character flaws is a bad term to use with Tilly. But the human side of things.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. We all have character flaws. None of us are perfect. And I think that's, like, one of the big criticisms that TNG gets is that it's so sterile. That these characters are so perfect that it's almost laughable at times when they are not perfect, because it's so silly. Versus Tilly is just, she's a normal person who, you know, of course she's very intelligent and she's very driven, right? But she's still a normal person. She still has things that make her uncomfortable, that make her upset, that make her excited and happy and all those different things.
Drop F-bombs.
It's the casual sex thing with Lorca and Cornwell. And I know the internet's, like, massively divided on this. It's why I have trouble paying attention to forums and Reddit and all that. Just because everybody just goes to the complete negative dive. And like I said, like 5 or 10 minutes ago, it was one of the things of the episode I actually understand the most. You know, they're constantly facing death. I mean, they've obviously been friends of some kind for a long time. Especially the way Cornwell was talking to him about, you know, I've seen you, I've known you, I've seen what you were, and I've seen what you're becoming. And for her to know him that well, him making a pass at her, I mean, I get it. That's a human thing. It's unusual for Star Trek, kind of, but not really. If you look at the Kirks and the Rikers,
I think it's the only time that a ranked character had sexual relations with a higher ranked character.
Okay, like an admiral to a...
Like a captain to an admiral. Now, I guess in Voyager, of course, you had B'Elanna and Tom Paris. She outranked him.
Come on. You know Picard and Nichea. Come on.
But that's really what I mean, is the captain level.
You're right.
The captain and an admiral. Because that's a direct hierarchy, right? Whereas, like, you know, Dax and Worf on Deep Space Nine, I mean, yeah, I think she outranked him, if I remember correctly. But either way, they're both, you know, commanders and that kind of thing.
And that's
there's T'Pol and Trip.
T'Pol and Trip.
Well, T'Pol though was sub commander. She had a Vulcan designation.
That's true.
It's a little.
See, I guess this is why I liked it. I didn't mind it so much. I in fact liked it, the character aspect of Lorca and Cromwell having some sort of attraction to each other, even if it's not a real relationship. I mean, that's reality. I always like seeing the real side of humanity in TV shows. And like Derek, you said, Star Trek Next Generation was criticized because the characters were, I mean, they were like the ideal person. And, you know, I always refer to Game of Thrones, but it's like what the author said, George R. R. Martin, about, you know, the best stories are about the human heart in conflict with itself. And you get that with Lorca, and I love it. In fact, look at all the stuff that happened in the episode, and I'm still talking about Lorca. I need to stop. So...
No, but you make a good point, though, because, like, a character like Lexuana Troi on TNG stands out in a very specific way. And on Deep Space Nine, she stood out mainly because they would pair her with characters like Odo, right? But if you were to take her and put her on Voyager or Discovery, where the shows don't take themselves quite as seriously, she's not as ridiculous. She blends in more.
Oh, the walk sound of Troy.
That's a funny thing to think about. Like, imagine Tilly having a one-on-one conversation with anyone from Next Generation. They would seem like aliens to her, because it would be so bizarre to have someone who has a real personality and like flaws talking to all of these people that are just so sanded edges off and perfect.
And to steal Derek's thunder, the Lwaxana Troi example, imagine the Lwaxana Troi meeting Tilly and seeing this beautiful, brilliant, but shy woman, what Lwaxana would try to do to her to get her to become more outgoing. You know, she would just make it her own personal goal. Yeah, that'd be amazing.
All right, so let's move on a little bit here. Let's talk about Tyler. I know a lot of people still think he's a Klingon. I gotta be honest, it makes less and less sense to me. I know they want you to think that, but it just doesn't work for me at all.
I'm not buying it.
Yeah, it seems like it's an intentional misdirect so that they can either undercut the misdirect and say like, haha, we fooled you, or do the double and be like, oh, we made it so obvious that you'd think it wouldn't be it, but it is it, and it's going to be like a double twist. I'm interested to see where it goes, because he's definitely, you know, ominous. There's something going on there. He's not just like I refuse to believe he's just a soldier that happened to have a relationship with the albino Klingon, you know, who we already saw have this kind of emotional relationship with the other Klingon that they made a big point of.
It would almost be more entertaining for the storyline if, instead of him being a Klingon that had lots of plastic surgery and all this, that he somehow during his 7 months they broke him and turned him into a double agent of some kind.
Right. Yeah. But, I mean, Michael even said that there's no way a human could physically take on that many Klingons.
Yeah, she does say that. And, of course, you know, you saw his score during the training exercise, and, you know, he got 36 kills and Lorca got, you know, 24. Clearly he's a skilled being of some kind, but Star Trek has done a lot of Trekno-babble, Techno-babble things to explain stuff. And the idea that at this time period, we could have a Klingon become so human physically that we would not notice it in any type of exam. Just seems far-fetched.
Well, the two livers and like the eight chamber heart and
exactly.
But we also know that that they went back to the matriarchs, and the matriarchs have some grand, you know, abilities that we've yet to see. There's a lot of ancient Klingon science that appears to be on the verge of magic. That I feel like there's really anything that they could pull out at this point. Like,
I mean, yeah, he could have had, you know, something to do with the eugenics project, but why is he no longer an albino? I don't know.
It would have made more sense if they turned him into another species or made him look like another species that maybe humanity hasn't encountered, but the Klingons have, and he could have been a Klingon slave on this planet and blah, blah, blah. And then Lorca rescues him and also realizes, wait a second, this guy's pretty good firing a phaser. He's my new security chief.
I wonder if Ash is going to trigger Saru's threat ganglion at some point.
Oh, maybe. I mean, you would think that Lorca wouldn't care if he was human or not, because Saru is his first officer.
Yeah.
But then you start thinking about it and you realize that most of the other characters are all human.
That's true, except for the kind of android helmsman somewhere. And
yeah, but we don't even know that, like, that character never yeah, speaks, never talks. Right? So you've got Burnham, Tilly, Stamets, the doctor, I'm drawing a blank on his name. You know, those are your other characters. They're all human.
Good point.
Yeah.
You know, and Lorca's human. So of the main seven cast members now that are on the ship, only one is not human.
That's a very good point.
So, I don't know. I guess for me, it just seems a little too convenient. And I'm not saying they can't explain it, because it's science fiction and they can just say, well, the good thing we invented the whatever. But I never like that kind of writing, because it just seems forced. Like, yeah. Hey, this would be really cool. We don't know how to make it work, so we'll just make up something. And when it's an overarching plot like this, it becomes more powerful of a device. And that's not necessarily a good thing.
I'm still holding out hope that somehow their genetic tampering with Ash becomes the reason that Klingons look like Worf in the future. So maybe it like gets out of control and goes through the entire Klingon Empire, and they all like that fixes the continuity of them looking like crazy monster aliens.
but in Enterprise they look like Worf.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah. Well, that's what, 10 years after this?
No, Enterprise is
before. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like 90 years earlier.
Ah, damn it! That doesn't work then.
So, yeah, that's still like, don't get me wrong. They say they'll explain it. I'm gonna give them the benefit of the doubt on that, but it's gonna be a tough thing to explain.
Yeah,
they might have been better off just saying, "Look, this is the style we wanted to go with because it's based off of yada yada," and then move on.
Yeah, just don't answer any more questions about it. You're right. If the showrunners would just say this is what we wanted to do, then people would drop it.
Yeah, because like I'm not gonna argue about it. Like they look the way they look. I don't think they look bad by any means. But when they add on the "don't worry, it's all explained," well, okay, so now I have an expectation. You've told me you're gonna explain it. So how are you gonna pull that off?
Yep. Yeah.
Well, and that's the other thing that makes me think that it's going to be the what everybody expects, that he's going to turn out to just be a Klingon, is that I haven't been super impressed with the writing so far. Like, things have been fairly predictable. And there have been a few holes and some questions that I don't think are going to get answered. So I kind of don't put it past them that this is going to be what it is.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's talk about the Katra long distance calls that Burnham keeps taking that I'm sure are collect calls.
Right.
So this, of course, is an extension of The Wrath of Khan and the fall of the next two movies after it, where Spock gives his Katra, his soul, to Bones, and Bones carries it for a while. This is that same kind of concept. So at some point, Michael Burnham was near death after that bombing, and in order to save her life, Sarek mind-melded with her and shared his Katra to help her heal. So now they're connected across space and time, which is an interesting idea.
Yeah, it reminds me of some of the science from Ender's Game, where they have like the particles are separated across vast distances, and their vibrations allow them to communicate.
Yes. It's
one of those like pseudoscience.
Yeah, the Ender's Game Ansible.
Well, so in Ender's Game, though, to give him a little bit of credit, in the sequel books, it's actually explained that the entire network is essentially the brain system of a living being.
Yeah, all right.
And so it goes pretty deep. The Ender's Game books get weird.
I kind of fell off when he made the telepathic sister and brother that were children in a weird spaceship out of his mind. That's when I was like, okay.
Oh, yeah. The egg ship thing. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Well, I think Orson Scott Card was a guest writer on Discovery this year, so.
Oh, well, there you go.
I completely just made that up, so CBS, please.
No, I certainly hope not. I read a lot of the Ender's Game books before I knew much about Orson Scott Card himself. Not the best person on the planet.
Probably.
His skills of an author, as an author, is very different from his humanity aspects.
Yes, that is true. I mean, seriously, if you look up online, if you just want to know the timeline for the Ender's Game franchise, just like a web of what these books look like and what order to read them in, it's unreal. There's all these different branches and companion novels and like all this other crazy stuff. Like there's this character in Ender's Game, Bean, who's the really little kid, and he has his own companion novel. I've read it.
He has his whole series, the Shadow. Yeah.
Right. You learn about all his kids and all his crazy stuff. He just did a new prequel trilogy. It's crazy. Anyway,
sorry, sidetrack.
So the long distance Katra. How do you guys feel about that?
It's interesting. I definitely am excited to see what Stamets does with it, because Stamets got real excited when he heard that there's like, oh, maybe a replacement for the Mycenaeum Spore, whatever, network. Like maybe he can travel through the soul dimension or something.
Yeah, you just need the soul gem from Thanos.
Oh, crossover.
Yeah. Greg, I got the feeling you're not a big fan.
Okay. There's two parts to me on this. So far, the three instances they've talked about it, when she was injured way back when and he did it, his mind meld, excuse me. Then when she's on the Shenzhou as it's getting just, you know, obliterated, and he communicates with her again. And then now when Sarek is like mortally injured almost, or he is mortally injured until they save him. I'm okay if they use it in circumstances like that. What I don't want it to become is just another, I'm going to hold my fingers to my head and I'm going to think across 15 light years and immediately communicate. Because I think it takes
Be fair, she did get a small piece of metal to put up against the side of her
head. This is true. It's just, I don't want it to take away from the other aspects of Star Trek that are so cool, like the subspace beaming or the subspace communications and the warp drive for communication aspects. Because there's always that risk of, man, if our message doesn't get to them in time, that we may not get help. But if they just have an answer that every time one of them stubs their toe, they can instant communicate. I don't want them to overuse it, is what I'm saying.
That seems to be a theme of Discovery, where they're taking out the barrier that is kind of space travel. Like, distance is no longer a factor if they can just be anywhere, whenever. And now even, like, physical location isn't necessarily a problem if you can use, like, mind meld to remote desktop into someone's brain and reboot them.
Well, I almost wish they would add some sort of risk to using it. Like, in Next Generation, when Picard took Sarek's emotions because Sarek had that illness.
God, I love that.
Exactly. That episode, Picard basically took the illness on.
Bendai syndrome?
Yeah, the Bendai syndrome. He took the illness on, and Pete and, you know, Crusher and company were like, well, what if we can't reverse this? And everybody's like, that's a huge risk. You just risked the captain of the flagship. The negotiations are important, but there was a risk to it. You know, there was...
Well, in Discovery here, I think you're totally right that there's this big risk that they're going to overuse it. Because if you look at the movies in the Kelvin timeline, Into Darkness brought in this concept of, well, you know, the transwarp beaming or the subspace beaming or whatever, where you could transport from Earth to Kronos with a transporter. And Beyond basically pretends that movie never happened.
Yep.
Right? So, you know, there's no giant vengeance Section 31. There's no beaming from planet to planet across, you know, vast hundreds of light years. They just skip all of that. And I think they realize that, wait, we just created a bit of a problem for why you would ever need a starship. So,
which, you know, and it's entirely my fault, because in 2009 Star Trek, when they did the transport from planet to ship, I never remembered them calling that transport beaming. And then Into Darkness it was. And then I was like, holy crap, beaming from one moon to a planet in the same system is one thing versus, like you said, they're going from Earth to Kronos. At that point, why even send a ship to Kronos? Just beam over 1,000 torpedoes and just hope for the best. I mean...
Exactly. And so this runs that same risk, is that if she can connect to Sarek whenever they want, you know, it's almost like you have call a friend available after every question.
Well, and that's what I worry about, that in like four or five, six episodes from now, the Discovery is going to be surrounded by, you know, 9 Klingon battle cruisers, and she's going to hold up her hand, you know, Professor X style, and then all of a sudden 30 Vulcan warships drop out of warp. And I'm going to be like, why?
And speaking of conventions that they're already kind of wearing out the welcomes of, we start this episode 2 in another one of Michael's dream sequences. It's like she is constantly just having dreams that we are seeing. I think this is the fourth one in 6 episodes.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah.
But the thing I like about this, I don't mind whining about this, because complaints like this to me are almost implementation complaints of the show, not necessarily the story of the show. And like I said, unless her little super mind meld ruins an episode, but it shows you the overall strength of what the show's doing with some of the characters and at least some of the storyline. Although, like Jeremy's been saying, you know, this is the 6th episode and we still don't know exactly what's going on with the war. We keep getting getting glimpses of it.
Yeah, it would be kind of cool if they gave us some type of progress report in some way to know, here's how much time has passed in the war and here's the systems and that kind of thing. I think that would be interesting.
Remember there was that episode of Deep Space Nine before they talk about retaking DS9 during the war. And they're talking about, the 7th Fleet or whatever, we're waiting for reinforcements. And Bashir walks in, he's like, oh, we've heard from the 7th Fleet, only 12 ships survived. And Martok screams. He's like 12 out of 104. And that just shows that one 25-second clip just lets you know that things are not going well for the next generation. They don't have to show anything else. It was that one clip just to go, things aren't going well, or things could be going well. Then again, like we talked about a couple weeks ago with yesterday's Enterprise, apparently, you know, that war with the Klingons didn't go well for us either.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, because at the end of the day, you would think the Klingon Empire should be able to take the Federation in a fight.
They're a warrior culture, yeah.
But
especially if they can grant cloaking technology as a reward.
Yeah, just at will.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that seems a little sketchy to me that they're like it's that easy to install. It's like swapping out your RAM sticks or something. Like, yeah. I don't know. I feel like cloaking technology should be complicated.
Although maybe somehow they'll tie it into the original series storyline where the Romulans traded cloaking technology for warbirds or warships from the Klingons. Maybe in a couple episodes there's going to be a Romulan on board with the Klingons showing them how to install cloaking technology.
So
they specifically said that Romulans were completely off the table in the first episode of that After Trek show.
Maybe it's just another misdirection, I hope.
To be fair, only the Federation hasn't seen the Romulans in like 80 years or 200 years or whatever it was. There's no reason the Klingons haven't seen the Romulans.
That's a good point.
Well, and also, don't we find out in Nemesis or one of them that the Vulcans and the Romulans are like, they have a long history together?
No, that's actually in Unification in TNG.
They're basically the same species almost, just like a subspecies of each other. But
right, when they had the psychic weapon that they were looking for the pieces of.
Yeah, I mean, basically what happened was that a group of Vulcans decided to embrace their emotion, and they left the planet. This is basically what happened, and then you got Romulus. Yeah. And that's what that is. All right, so before we run out of time, I want to talk a little bit about Stamets, because he seemed like a completely different character this week.
He's real giddy.
So my question is he giddy because he was really that excited, or is he really a different version of himself like they were trying to imply at the end of last week's episode?
Well, I mean, he is at his core a scientist who's obsessed about this one field of study, and he's probably been at it for a long time, and now he's basically his own test subject. So it wouldn't make sense that he's no longer has that frustration of having incomplete jumps and not having control over the tardigrade and all this stuff. So, I mean, it's fair that he would have this bit of a personality shift, because the things that were making him grumpy would no longer be making him grumpy.
I still say he's turning into a water bear.
I mean, it's possible.
Did you see the controversy about the game developer who said that they took his idea?
No.
There's a big thing going around. I know I used to be a game developer, and some of the people in my network on Twitter, they said that there's a guy who made a game that's still in early development, but the core of the game involves a giant space tardigrade that is used for transportation across like space-based distances. And there are side-by-side comparisons to some of the graphics that he uses for it. I've seen them. They're pretty crude on his end. But he started development on this game and presented some stuff about it before Discovery was even picked up. So that might become a lawsuit at some point. But it was interesting to see the side-by-side on that.
I mean, that's going to be tough since a tardigrade is a real creature that exists. You can't really have a trademark on that.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, the Bug's Life and the Ant movie. You know,
or ants,
Yeah, ants, right. Like, there are ants. Ants are a thing. I don't think you can really stop a company from making a movie about ants. You know? Yeah. so good luck with that lawsuit. But, I mean...
I don't think there's actually going to be one. It's just something that people were saying, like, ooh, look, things are very close. But, tardigrades were just a hot science thing for the last 5 years or so.
Well, because we've learned a lot about them recently. Yeah. And so it's just kind of this thing that's really interesting and different, you know. Anything else that you guys want to touch on for Star Trek Discovery?
So for this episode, it was interesting that this is the first time we actually see Lorca sit in the captain's chair. He had not done that prior to this episode. He's always walking around, so this is his first seated captain moment. It was also interesting to see how the Vulcan logic extremist killed himself, or, you know, turned himself into a bomb. We didn't talk much about that, where he injected himself with some red stuff and just became an explosive device. Very,
I feel like that has been done before. I don't remember if it was Star Trek, but I feel like that specific kind of death has happened in sci-fi.
Yeah. Iron Man 3, they all exploded.
No, that was different. Yeah. That's, yeah. But no, there, I distinctly remember it being like a suicide bomber kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I'm drawing a blank on what it is now, but it looked really familiar.
I have to go research that.
Another interesting factoid for this episode, and these are all cribbed from Memory Alpha, of course, but Jason Isaacs did the fight choreography for a large part of that combat sequence in the hologram. Just like he choreographed the action himself, which is a cool little tidbit.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Lorca is a badass in real life and in a fantasy world.
I'm not really surprised. That's why I was looking forward to seeing him in this role. And I'm also not super surprised that he's not the most just and moral character in the world. No offense to Jason Isaacs, but he plays this kind of character really well.
Oh yeah, Malfoy.
So, yeah.
I also love that Malfoy has a ship that can apparate.
Well, you are not wrong.
Oh man, that's the first time that occurred to me. That's lovely. That's great.
Some other firsts for this episode. This is the first time they actually mention Enterprise. So tying it back into the rest of the world. Like, we saw Archer on that list of captains in last week's episode, but this is the first time they straight up mention that Spock is on the Enterprise, kind of tying it into the non-Kelvin timeline.
Well, I think they even said a Constitution ship class like the Enterprise, right?
That was Burnham's line. Yeah. It was in the opening scene on Discovery, not the one on Vulcan.
Yeah, talking to Tilly, that's right.
Because that's the command track, and I thought it was interesting that the command track would be specific ships. That, you know, if you want to be a captain, you don't want to be on a science vessel.
Right.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
I also love the computer giving the helpful tips about the food. I feel like that would get annoying so fast.
Yeah, but it does feel like it fits the direction that our society is currently going. But I do like, and this is some people keep talking about how they've made advancements on Discovery, that things look too advanced. But they have the same replicators as the original series, where it's all behind a door.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that's a little detail that I think people are overlooking that shows that they are paying attention. These are Star Trek fans. They know what the original series is. But they also know that it's now 2017, 51 years later, and we have to use updated special effects.
Look, I just don't want the computer to judge me, you know. Commander Bosco, that is your 19th taco today. I'm like, I've had a rough day, all right? I don't need you back talking to me on this. You know, if I go,
yeah, I'll probably get cut off.
I need 6 Boulevard Wheats, and the computer just refuses. I'm like, come on.
Especially if it's loud enough for everyone else in the cafeteria to hear. I feel like that's just setting people up for bullying.
Now, I will be interested, because they showed them drinking alcohol, Lorca and Cornwall, in this episode. I'm curious to see if they keep that consistent, because synthahol did not exist in the original series.
That's true. Yeah.
So I'll be curious to see how that turns out.
That was probably in Jimmy Doohan's writer. It's like, if we're drinking, we're really drinking.
Well, it's one of my favorite moments in the TNG episode Relics, where Scotty is on there and he's at the bar with Data.
Right.
And he doesn't like the synthahol and he drinks his green drink, and it is green. All right. Well, on that note, I think we are going to close things up for this week's episode of Red Shirts and Runabouts. Thank you for tuning in, of course, to the Heroes Podcast Network. Jeremy, if people want to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
I am Zen Munkin on Twitter, and I'm also hosting another podcast on the network called the Saturday Morning Tooncast, where we talk about cartoons. That goes up on Saturdays.
And Greg?
You can find me on Twitter at @the_bittersteel, and that's also the same email at @the_bittersteel@yahoo.com.
And I am the Star Trek Dude on Twitter and Facebook. You can catch me on a couple of our other shows, Screen Heroes and Gamer Heroes, other podcasts on the network. Screen Heroes streams live every Tuesday night on Twitch at 9 p.m. Eastern. So come join us and chat with us on Twitch. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We will catch you next week. Live long and prosper.